For the first time, middle-aged men and women are the largest, most influential, and richest segment in the country, floating somewhere between 40 and 64. They constitute one-third of the population and control nearly 70% of its net worth. In booms and recessions, a trillion-dollar economy feeds and fuels their needs, whims, and desires. Better educated and healthier than the predecessors, these early and late midlifers are happier, more productive, and more involved than any other age group. That's the way Patricia Cohen begins her extremely interesting new book, In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age. She covers a lot in the book. The book is, she says, a biography of the idea of middle age from its invention in the second half of the 19th century to its current place at the center of American society. And a lot of the history of what we thought about middle age is really fascinating in this book. Patricia is our guest this hour. She has been a New York Times reporter for 13 years. She's also worked at the Washington Post, New York Newsday, and Rolling Stone. Her stories have led to many television and radio appearances. She's a regular participant in the Times Talk series and New York Times podcast. She has a BA from Cornell University, a graduate degree from the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. I guess we can say that she is a middle-aged woman and proud of it, and had got married later in life and had a child later in life. So that's all interesting. Patricia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I just found the history of this absolutely fascinating. What we thought about middle age in 1906 and 1903 and how people were writing about it, and there were renaissances of middle age, and then it disappeared. And did you know what the history was before you delved into this?
No, I didn't. And, you know, I'm so glad you started with that, because that is really my favorite part of the book.
Is it?
A lot of the press about it so far, which, of course, has been great, but has been a lot on the research findings, which, of course, are very interesting. But to me, what I just found really revelatory was this kind of untold history of middle age, which was that, you know, people did not think of themselves as middle age. You know, when I say the term middle age was invented, it kind of, people first stop a moment. Well, what do you mean? Of course, weren't people always middle aged? And yes, they were, but that wasn't the way people thought about themselves. It wasn't a kind of organizing principle. It wasn't an identity. Mm-hmm. And that really kind of became established at the end of the 19th century, actually at the same time that the idea of adolescence, which was a term that was not used previous to the 19th century, also came about. And that was the history that I just found so interesting and really something that has never been told fully.
Tell us, I was particularly interested, maybe because I've been thinking about my grandmother for some reason the last, I don't know, couple months. You know how people in your past just come to mind.
Sure.
And my grandmother has for some reason. And I was thinking, in terms of voting. She was a suffragette, and she was a very educated woman, you know, had a college degree, was a teacher, and then the
generation. Very unusual at that time.
Yeah, it was, but the generation that followed it was not as educated, and there was something about a renaissance of middle-aged women that was alive during her time that you write about in this book. It drew to a close.
Exactly.
But how did women particularly flourish in middle age? Why did they flourish at that time?
Well, one thing I just want to, before I get into that, when I was writing the book, or part of the time I was writing a book, was during the 2008 election, and you had at that time kind of Rush Limbaugh going on about, when Hillary Clinton at one point was still in the game, about how would people want to watch her age in the White House and talked about her fat ankles.
Oh,
and I thought, my God, you know, how far we have gone backward.
Yes,
100
yes.
years, because in fact the period between 1890 and 1920, which is often referred to as the progressive era in America, was actually a wonderful period for middle-aged women. In fact, better for women than for men. And that was for two reasons. One is that the suffragette or the feminist movement had really been split politically. And in 1890, they kind of reconciled and managed to get together. And, of course, that ultimately ended up in women getting the vote in 1920. But secondly, there were a lot of kind of social and cultural and as well as economic forces that were changing their lives in very substantial ways. So let's go back to 1800. The average woman, let's say, has 7 or 8 children. Mm. So by the time her last child is out of the house, she is probably dead.
Right, right.
Men are working on the farm. It's an agrarian society. They're, you know, everybody works kind of dawn till dusk, and you work as long as you're able to stand up. Okay, so now let's fast forward to 1900. And women are much more likely to have 3 kids, maybe 4 at the most. You've got a middle class that's emerging. And so by the time at this point that a woman is about 45, her child-rearing duties are really at an end. And for middle-class women, this whole new experience, this new period in life where they are, you know, still in good health but not chained to the house. They don't have to, you know, make the butter, make the clothes, that everything that they were charged with doing in a pre-industrial society. And it was this kind of flowering. And that's when you also get a lot of reform movements.
Yes.
That are powered by women. Men, on the other hand, who are now moving to factories, working men, find by 40, 45, they are not as desired in the factory because perhaps they're not considered as fast or as adaptable as their younger coworkers. So at this point, when economically men in middle age are finding a really tough time, for middle class women, you know, socially and politically, they're coming into their own.
Mm-hmm. What about this idea, and I wonder if it plays through history as well, that middle age is most successful for both men and women? And I'm thinking mostly of women because I'm a woman here. But if you have some greater purpose, the idea of the right to vote, the idea of women's rights in the 1960s and the 70s and beyond, that it has to be a part of a successful middle age and has always been so. And when it's not, when you're when times are rough, when it's a depression, when, you know, the idea of your society is to spend money and be a consumer instead of do good work, middle age is not as easy.
Well, you know, one of the things that research and particularly psychological research has found for years, and I'm going back now even to Erik Erikson, who I talk about in the book, back to 1950. Consistently, researchers have found that men, women, all across different socioeconomic groups, ethnicities, that having some kind of, you know, purpose or feeling that you are contributing to society always is a very important part, both of your own physical and mental health. And well as your outlook, and that has just been repeated often, and it's not a modern idea. In fact, you can go back to, and I quote this in the book, to John Stuart Mill, who makes the same point. And it really doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. And Erikson talked about one of the kind of signposts, in fact, the marker of middle age was what he called generativity, which was a kind of complicated word for saying it was the time when people felt it was their role to give back to society beyond the raising of their own children, but in some larger way, and that was ultimately the most satisfying and the most sure path to kind of a feeling of well-being and satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really has held true consistently over and over again across the board, not only for women, but of course it's been especially a poignant issue for women, and that was something, of course, Betty Friedan captured when she wrote about the feminine mystique back in the 60s.
The Eriksons did so much, didn't they, Erik and his wife Joan, to help us understand in a fairly deep way various stages of life. Were they really front and center in our understanding of middle age?
Yes, absolutely. There were theorists, including Carl Jung, in fact, who talked about middle age being an important period of development. But just to kind of set the stage here, you know, you had Freud in the early part of the century, who, of course, was incredibly influential, and his influence just seeped into every nook and cranny of society. But his view basically was that your kind of psychological profile was pretty much etched in stone by the time you were five. I mean, you know, that was it. Human development pretty much stopped by the time, you know, you were in grade school practically. And that view really persisted throughout much of the 20th century. And Carl Jung, actually, as well as another psychologist who's much less well-known than him, called G. Stanley Hall, and they were a couple of people who talked about the importance still of middle age. But it wasn't until really the late 50s, and Erikson was the first to introduce the idea that middle age was an important stage in of itself in human development. And, you know, it sounds so almost trite by now,
yes,
commonplace, that, yes, you know, your reaction is, well, that's so obvious. But it's hard to kind of recreate the mindset just how really revolutionary that thinking was. I mean, psychologists just did not think that was the case. And so the notion that people could still develop in a serious way after childhood, and in fact, just to illustrate this, there was no such thing as a field of adult development or human development. In fact, there was child development, and that's what psychologists looked at. The field of adult development, or sometimes referred to as human development, was not even, you know, created or established until after Erikson in the 50s.
Interesting. When did we become preoccupied with what happens to us sexually in middle age? When did all these fears of menopause and the Viagra industry and not being potent and not being as beautiful and losing beauty and losing your strength and your potency, when did that become the dominant thing that we talked about when we viewed middle age in this country? And there's still a lot of that now.
Right, of course. Well, you know, one of the reasons I love history is because, of course, you know, you go back and all of these things that you think are kind of coming for the first time, you find, oh, there's so much precedence for this. And there was this whole similar kind of industry, which they called at that time rejuvenation in the 1920s. And, you know, it was the age of science, the beginning of the age of science. And there were all of these doctors, some who looked at aging as a disease, in fact, from Nobel Prize winners to quacks, who were pushing all of these anti-aging treatments or solutions or were hoping for them. And so you had men were being transplanted, having their testes transplanted with monkey glands, and women were having their ovaries zapped with X-rays. I mean, this, you know, these horrible treatments now that we look at askance. Although I'm sure if you told people, well, we're going to inject botulism into people's faces,
right,
that probably would have elicited the same response. But you know, I mean, look, I think societies going back thousands of years, as far as we can tell, have been preoccupied with everything from fertility to beauty. That's nothing new. I think what has kind of amplified and ramped it up in a way that is new is just the marketing and the media that we have, and as that has become more extensive and more sophisticated over the previous decades, so have the emphasis on those things. And of course, America is probably preeminent in its fascination or obsession with youth, and that is just this kind of reinforcing loop that you see in movies and films and advertising and magazines and products and such, and it's really almost impossible to escape. Even if you want to escape it, it's hard to.
Does it have something to do, what's the connection between our being, as you call it, a consumption ruled world and aging in a consumption ruled world, that it's hard to do that because of the nature of what we're supposed to do.
Right, exactly. Well, two of the things that two of the forces that I see as perhaps the two most powerful forces or movements in the 20th century have been the self-help movement and mass consumerism. And in my mind, these two forces have really combined together to push what I just kind of jokingly called the midlife industrial complex after Eisenhower's phrase about the military. But just to say that there is this sprawling enterprise, and I think of it in a complex in two sense, a complex in terms of obviously it's this large economic juggernaut in a way with producing and creating all of these products and bombarding you with ads all of the time, pointing out your maladies or insufficiencies or inferiorities, and then coming up with the products to solve that problem. And so it's also a complex in a psychological sense in giving you an inferiority complex. And that's exactly what happened in the beginning of the century when mass consumerism really took off for the first time, because industrialization made it possible to produce in large enough numbers, and there was a transportation system that could distribute products across the country. And so you had advertisers coming up with all of these, you know, maladies that people didn't know existed before. Halitosis, bad breath,
right,
when that Listerine came up.
Yeah.
There was, what was it, I think bromidosis, which was sweaty feet. There was homatosis, which meant that you had bad furnishings in your house. I mean, it was, you know, all of these things that then they would come up with products to solve.
We have people who want to speak with you, Patricia, and we have much more to talk about. It's really a fascinating book. In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age. Patricia Cohen is our guest, reporter for the New York Times. An article about, not an excerpt from her book, but about the subject of the book was in, I think, I always want to call it the Weekend Review. I'm still in the week. It's Sunday Review now in the Times. Caught our attention, and We got to do the interview. We got to get the book, and that's why she is with us today. Here's our phone number. A line is open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Patricia also spent time in Madison because the Manhattan Project of Middle Age has been taking place at UW-Madison, the Institute on Aging. And they have done questionnaires, and she subjected herself to the questionnaires and also to some tests about middle age brains. And it was a fascinating time for her, which we'll ask her to tell us about in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, of course, the primary in Florida. Tomorrow, during our 9 o'clock segment, we will have two guests with us, a reporter from Florida Public Radio and also a political scientist to analyze the vote. That will be tomorrow at 9 o'clock. And NPR's coverage of the election today will begin at 7 o'clock tonight. You will hear it, of course, on the Ideas Network. Let's go to phone calls for Patricia. Bill in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Thank you for taking my call. I was waiting 12 minutes and just stuffed some food in my face at Starbucks.
Oh, no. Sorry.
I just wanted to reinforce what your author, it sounds like a fascinating book, mentioned about middle-aged women being liberated in the Progressive Era. There's a book that's just come out again, Oshkosh at 150, that has a chapter dealing with Oshkosh women. And surprisingly, there was a German immigrant who was also a medical doctor who was able to get very involved with La Follette and the suffragette movement, as well as another number of women who were very involved during that period. And when reading about this, as I was involved in the book, is written by Michael Gock, who's done a number of books in Wisconsin about various communities. But I was quite astounded at that time to see the role that women had taken as quite different from what I envisioned in I remember a little bit from people talking about the 40s and certainly the 50s and early 60s. I don't know if your author would like to comment on that. But
I'm sure she would, Bill. Thank you.
Well, yes, exactly. That point about women really making incredible breakthroughs during that period of time. And there was this phrase called the Renaissance of Middle Age, which became popular at that time. And it really did apply to women because it was really the first time that women began to take a public role in society. You know, think back, we all know now about, you know, Abigail and John Adams and how, because of their letters, she was a really important force in his thinking and his decision-making. But women were still pretty much relegated to the domestic sphere. They didn't really have a public role in society. And this was the first time that women really were, you know, able to carve out some space for themselves.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Somebody who can stay on the line, which we really haven't answered. What age constitutes middle age now, Patricia? Was it 30 to 45 years in the 1800s, and now it is question mark?
Well, this is a question everybody always asks, and as I say, I kind of talk about this period floating between 40 and 64, but you know, the chronological age is in some ways the least meaningful or useful, because most people really think about middle age much more in terms of where they are in relationship to others in their lives, or their children grown up, or their parents failing, or have they died, where are they in their career, or they think about it psychologically, how much time do I have left, as opposed to how much time I've already spent. And so when it comes to picking a number, that number changes depending on who you ask. Women tend to think middle age starts earlier than men. Working class people, laborers, tend to think it also starts earlier than professionals. It changes even depending on what region of the country you're in. There was a Pew Foundation study in 2009, I think, that asked people between 55 and 64 at what age middle age ended, and the answer was 71. So I what I say about middle age is that I find it's, I call it a never land. Younger people never want to enter it, and older people never want to leave it.
I like that description very, very much. What about for people, both you and I had children later in life and got married later in life as well, which for me is sort of put me in this, you know, time of life when people have their grandkids. Usually I was having my kid or close to it, and I think it changes for me the whole notion of middle age, that there's something that is you're sort of mixed up with it, because you're thinking, your mind's thinking, I don't have that much time left, but you're also at a very early point in your child's development, so it puts you in a never land.
Well, this is exactly what I mean by the number being so much less important than the social point, mm-hmm. that you are sociologically or you know, how you relate to others. Right, if you're, you know, changing diapers or looking at preschools, it's hard to think of yourself at this middle point or this turning point in your life. I mean, maybe you are, but only because you have a young child. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, particularly as cultural mores and the kind of regimentation has loosened a lot in terms of this very, you know, kind of forced progression from school to marriage to then having a child, buying a house, settling down. I mean, our society is so much looser, family arrangements are so different now, that it's really much harder to locate in any way. And one of the things I say in the book, in fact, that there isn't one middle age, but many middle ages, and that they really change and depend on your own personal circumstances, as well as this variety of kind of off-the-rack middle ages that were offered in the culture.
Mm-hmm. Linda in Milwaukee. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, as far as middle age, I'd like to say I'm 46 years old. So if you multiply that times two, I'm pretty sure I'm middle-aged. That's the way I look at it. But at any rate, my question is, I am one of the, what I see, see to be growing numbers of middle-aged women who are caring for their adult children and or their grandchildren. And I want to know if that is a rarer, if it's a newer phenomena, or if that's something that over history was, we were just expected to keep raising kids forever. Or, you know, because like my mom, her middle age was nice and relaxing.
Exactly.
And I'm not finding that.
Yes, yes. Well, you raise a really interesting point. In fact, at first I thought what you were going to say is that you were caring for your older children as well as your older parents, and which is, I think, even more common at this point as people are living longer. And, you know, hence this term, the sandwich generation, that has come about in the last decade or so about middle-aged people being squeezed from both sides. But the phenomenon that you're talking about is also true as well with women at your age also being thrown back into taking care of grandchildren for any number of different reasons. And I actually talk about this at one point in the book, and it is as if your circumstance is much more similar to women in the earlier part of the 19th century who were taking care of children through their 40s and 50s because really at the time that their, let's say their last child was born, was also the time that perhaps their first grandchild was born. And so it was this kind of undifferentiated period of child raising that just never stopped.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Linda, for the call. I want to go to Madison for a moment because there's amazing work being done, and you got involved in being analyzed as a middle-aged woman, the MacArthur, what do you call it, the MacArthur Project
right. Well,
of Middle Age.
Right. It was started in 1989, and it was originally funded by a foundation, a private foundation, the MacArthur Foundation. And then after 10 years, it was taken over by the federal government. I shouldn't say taken over. It was financed by the federal government, the National Institutes of Health. And the headquarters is really located at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And it's just this enormous, sprawling research project that hopefully will go on for decades to come, where they've looked at, there's an international component as well, but they've been following thousands of people and being able to look at them, how they change over time. And the third round is just about to start. They just got funding for it. And the work that researchers are doing in Madison is absolutely fascinating. And the survey, which is at the center of this, it's called Midlife the Midlife in the United States. And this study is, the results are being accessed by hundreds of researchers all over the country who are able to look at the survey results, which are really an extraordinary collection of information, both biological as well as psychological and sociological. And there's really not a set of data much like that anywhere else.
And you went through psychological testing yourself and physical testing?
Well, what I did was there's a scientist at a psychologist at the University of Wisconsin, Richard Davidson, who's just doing fascinating work. And he's actually worked previously with the Dalai Lama, and he's looked a lot in meditation and looking at the brain, how the brain functions. And he's taken MRIs of the brain and looking at what parts of the brain are kind of lighting up when you're thinking about certain things, when you're happy or sad. And so I was able to go and kind of get a picture of my brain taken. Right. So I saw that I needed more storage space, clearly. But anyway, his work is ongoing, and he's done just really fascinating work. And what he and others are trying to figure out is, what can we do now? What can people in middle age do now to protect and enhance both their cognitive functioning later in life and also their physical health, in the same way that you might look at, okay, what habits can we do now to reduce our risk of heart disease later on in life? you know, are there things that we can do in terms of the way we react to stress and other things like that also to reduce our risk of heart disease or diabetes, type 2 diabetes later on? Because mm-hmm. they've obviously this connection between stress and physical health is a very important one.
Yeah, I really think you have to move, don't you? I noticed that. I mean, just pure.
Right. Well, I think, you know, people never want to hear this, but if there is one fountain of youth, it's definitely physical exercise.
Right.
And all, not only does that help your physical health, but also your mental health. So I guess if fear of fat isn't getting you into the gym, maybe, you know, fear of losing some of your cognitive skills might.
Right. Yeah, but, sure. And I think that's a worry of people as they approach
exactly.
upper middle age.
I mean, one of the things that Davidson believes in, you know, people have to recognize that brain research is still really in its infancy. But he believes that through meditation that people can actually control, take steps to learn how to control their stress without drugs, that the brain is incredibly plastic, or which is another word for flexible, and that it's a much more fine-tuned tool to controlling stress than any drug you could take, and that people really should try to look at this behavior that they can modify and in effect then change their reactions in the brain.
Mm-hmm. You write in that particular chapter, study has revealed, and this has changed our earlier perceptions, middle age to be a time of psychological complexity when individuals become less neurotic and more open, reflective, and flexible.
Right, exactly.
That's
It's so interesting in a way that, just as I was saying before, that Freud thought pretty much that psychological development stopped at age 5. There is this kind of ongoing theory or intellectual impulse that we have inborn limits. And so you can see an analogy of that was that the brain that, you know, basically cells in the brain stop developing. You wouldn't get any new cells in adulthood, which we have found out not to be the case, and in fact that the brain still changes. And in fact, they've also found that myelin, which is that kind of fatty sheath that protects our brain cells, is the white matter in our brain, actually increases in middle age, and that can help neurotransmitters kind of talk to each other in the brain. So even though it is true that there are certain kinds of cognitive skills, memory is one obvious one that fall off as we age, there is also reason that wisdom has traditionally been associated with aging, because there's a whole different set of skills that we acquire through learning and experience and education that not only compensate in certain ways, but also add to other skills that we have.
Yeah. Wisdom. Wisdom is a good thing, isn't it, Patricia?
Yeah, let's hope.
I know. Well, let's go to the part. I'm sure that this is what captivates the popular press and People magazine, et cetera, and I'm not beneath talking about some of this, so let's do it. Which you do, too, is a matter of, because you have to analyze the huge industry that's trying to keep everybody 25 or 30 or 35, and that is playing to our fears and our desires to look youthful even though we're 75 years old. It is a fascinating thing that's going on, and it's a huge industry and only going to get bigger, I think, as baby boomers go into their 70s and beyond. You went to this conference in Las Vegas where they're selling all kinds of things, and I just want your, what road did you walk down? What did you see? What were people trying to sell you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, this is an anti-aging conference, and it happens every year, not only in Las Vegas and everywhere else, but, at different cities around the world. But, I mean, all you have to do is kind of flash through the internet or any magazine to see all of these potions and serums and fixes that you can get. There was one of my favorite was, it was kind of like this little roller, looked like a roller that you put paint on the wall, except it was very tiny enough to do on your face, and there were little needles in it.
Oh,
the idea that you were supposed to roll this over your face, and by the needles going into your face doing damage essentially would cause the skin to regenerate, which would then make you look better.
Right.
Then I loved, oh, there was like a $70,000 kind of oxygen capsule that you would put yourself in, which reminded me in those science fiction movies, you know, when you send you into space and put you in suspended animation to come out years later, that you were supposed to sit in there and get your body fully oxygenated, and that would somehow help you to look younger. Or losing weight by, this was the kind of latest version, I guess, of those old machines that we saw on television, that these belts that would make you jiggle up and down.
Right, right.
It was kind of making you jiggle up and down from your feet. I know all it made me want to feel was seasick, actually, by the time that I got off. But, I mean, it's everything, you know, creams with 24-karat gold in them. Now, why we should necessarily think that should help your skin, I don't know. But, you know, it's these products. Many people mistakenly think that a lot of these anti-aging supplements, I'm not only now even talking about beauty treatments, but nutritional supplements or you know, various vitamins and pills are approved by the FDA, and they're not. So there's a lot of stuff out there that's very easily available and available in health food stores and elsewhere that really has just not been studied and we don't know the effects of.
Tell me about human growth hormone. How much research is going on? How many people are taking this?
Well, it's very hard to estimate how many people take it because it's one of these things that you're not really supposed to take, or you're not allowed to take legally anyway as an anti-aging supplement. But there, it was one of these things that there was a very small test of that was written up in a medical journal in the early 90s, and that kind of zapped around the world like wildfire suddenly, that people had somehow found this magical cure and for aging. And what people don't realize is that human growth hormone is very much like a steroid, you know, that you take, and that it naturally declines over time. And the effects of it are really unknown, and yet people are taking it, and there can be all sorts of deleterious side effects. Some researchers even worry, although they haven't established it yet, that it may be linked to cancer. Because one theory is that the reason the body kind of cranks down the production of human growth hormone is to make it less likely that you'll get cancer and have these cells that produce, you know, uncontrolled, and that by stopping that, therefore you're letting it be more likely that you might have this uncontrolled wild growth of cells like cancer cells. But yet it's very popular. You know, people don't really want to face what are the can be the serious physical downsides.
Yeah. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
What about our intelligence in middle age? Intelligence quotient, IQ?
Right. Well, that's one of the things that has really received a lot of study and is continuing to. And that goes to one of the points I was saying before about different kinds of cognitive skills. I think the more that people understand the way the brain works, I guess they've begun to think of intelligence not so much as this one unitary thing that you could kind of put on a scale, like a quart of milk and whey, but rather a collection of dozens or scores or maybe even hundreds of different skills that contribute to our intelligence. So there are things, inborn skills that researchers tend to see as more genetic, perhaps, and those are known as fluid intelligence skills, and those are the kinds of things that are often tested on IQ tests or maybe SATs, and those involve memory or speed of calculation and abstract thinking. But then you've got this whole other set of skills called crystallized intelligence skills that really are much more influenced by our environment and also by what we learn and our predispositions, you know, our desire to really stick with something.
having, all of these other factors that affect our learning. And those are the things that, of course, improve over time. And those include things like verbal ability, social reasoning, so managing people, let's say, policy decisions. There was a study recently by economists that found that people were least likely to make mistakes in financial matters at age 53, because it was this combination of experience, learning, evaluations of risk, all of those things that go into making judgments.
That is so specific, at the age of 53.
Well, I say, it's really, that's the mean age. So
right.
It would really be between 43 and 63, and that's the kind of average that it comes out to. But people forget that what we consider intelligence is really made up of something that's contributed by a lot of different skills, that it's not just one unitary factor.
Patricia Cohen is our guest this hour, and she's written a fascinating book, In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age. Patricia has been a New York Times reporter for a number of years. She's also worked at the Washington Post and Rolling Stone. Her stories have led her to many television and radio shows, and she is regularly participating in the Times Talk series and the New York Times podcasts. Here's our phone number. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd like to have you. 800-486-8655. The email, which you can also use, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today is the Florida primary. Tonight at 7, NPR will have coverage of the election, and you can hear that here on the Ideas Network. And we have been covering all these races pretty extensively. Tomorrow, during our 9 o'clock hour, a political reporter from Florida Public Radio will be joining us, and we'll have an assistant professor of political science at Florida State University talking about the results from the primary in the Sunshine State. And that's tomorrow at 9 o'clock here on our program. And I know other shows will be covering this political race as well. Joy, I think, has 7 to 8 o'clock hour reserved for what happened in Florida today, tomorrow on her show. Let's go to Dawn in Chicago next. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. I would like to ask about the benefits of religion, religious faith, beyond spirituality and beyond meditation, but religion and faith.
Well, I think that that is definitely one of the subjects that the Midas study has been looking at. And I think that, religious faith often provides people with a feeling of purpose and, that there is meaning in their lives, which is very important. I mean, one of the things that becomes very clear from the research is that feeling in control of your life, feeling that you have a purpose, having a social network, are key ingredients to having a healthy older, both middle age and older age, both physically and psychologically. And churches, synagogues, mosques, religion helps to provide all of those things in terms of, one, a strong social network, in terms of often volunteer opportunities, feeling that there is you're doing something for others, and also feeling this purpose in life. So I think a lot of times people who are involved in that definitely have shown benefits.
Matthew in Spring Green. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Oh, I'm actually really good.
Good.
Am I supposed to just talk? I'm
sure.
Actually calling. I'm a 48-year-old middle-aged man, and your earlier caller had a daughter with grandchild, and I actually do, too. I have 7 kids, and my oldest daughter moved home with us, has a 3-year-old, so I have a 3-year-old grandson living with us. And, basically I was a stay-at-home dad after my wife. We got her through pancreatic cancer.
Oh.
And,
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah, actually, it was a good story, but then, you know, recently I went back and got my EMTB so I can start working as a EMT out of the acoustic engineering field. But I've changed that to be more home-based. And I love that we're having this discussion. Have you ever read the book, The Future of the Body by Michael Murphy?
I'm not familiar with that particular book.
Okay. It deals a lot with the whole metaphysical aspect of various cultures and attributes that have developed according to stressors or the roles that they play in their lives. And
right.
When you were talking about stress, I had the, and it's not really an epiphany or anything, but when we were fighting pancreatic cancer, the days that I was focused on finding and fighting, answers, those days I didn't feel nearly as much stress. But days that there wasn't a whole lot on the agenda.
Right.
I totally get where people are coming from if you have a purpose, it's much easier to stay on an even keel.
Right. Well, and not only a purpose, which I think your comment illustrates, but also the sense that you have some control over your life. So the days that you were doing something where you felt you were taking action. And interestingly, that is one of the really critically important elements in terms of, again, both physical and mental health, the sense that you have control over your life. Because one of the things that researchers found, and which your own experience as well as the previous caller show, is that middle age is often a time when stresses are at a height for all of the reasons we talked about, work, caring for kids and parents. But what middle-aged people responded was also that they felt more capable of managing those stresses. So even though they were at a high, they felt they were at the height of their capabilities, that they were up to the challenge. And that is critically important. And they've shown that both on a neurological level, literally in the physical way that manifests itself in your body, and in terms of stress as well, and your reaction to stress, that if you feel you have some control over your situation, that you can improve it, that makes an enormous difference.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Matthew. Matthew certainly has had his measure of stress. Thank you for calling. Well, at the risk, we will move off of this, of being getting close to the end of the hour on a downer note, but maybe you'll say this isn't the case. Are these middle years the last full measure of our health? Do things start to decline physically in the body after the middle years?
Well, yeah, I don't want to be Pollyanna here, obviously. There are clearly things that start declining. I mean, even people who are in good health, your back aches a little more, really bounce back as quickly as you do. Middle age is often a time when, longer-term illnesses or problems begin to show themselves. But by the same token, I think that one of the things that really characterizes middle age today as opposed to 50 years ago or 100 years ago is how much healthier people are. Our problem now is controlling kind of the surfeit of things that we have, food and health. I mean, the reason that people are so much healthier today is really things over which we had a lot of control. It was sewage and sanitation and clean food and, proper living conditions, which were mostly responsible for the extension in life, much more important than any kind of medical breakthroughs. That really had the biggest effect on lengthening our life expectancy from the 19th to the 20th century. And now, with all of these medical breakthroughs, we're extending it even further. But at the same time, while, of course, physically your body is falling off in a lot of ways, you can still do so much to keep it in good shape. So the problem is just
actually doing that, as we can see by the obesity epidemic. It's
right.
Very hard to control that.
Yeah. And we only have 30 seconds, but you end the book talking about work. And it's interesting, well, when you look at the demos, there's this huge baby boom generation. And then there are a lot of people who ought to be able to find work into their middle years and perhaps as long as they want to work, huh?
Right, exactly. I mean, obviously, we're in an economic downturn now, and that's terrible for any age. And it's hard for middle-aged people to get a job if they've been fired. The thing, though, that I think will change, and this is small comfort now, but in 10 years is just that the workforce numbers are going to completely change and we will have a labor shortage. And so hopefully that will make it easier across the board, on the one hand, for people to find work.
Mm-hmm. Well, Patricia, the book is just so interesting, and thank you for the hour. I enjoyed it so much. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Patricia Cohen, the book is In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll have news coming up. Just a reminder, it's Florida election primary day for the Republicans, and the results will be in tonight. So listen to us on the Ideas Network at 7 o'clock. For analysis from NPR. We will be with you analyzing this, my show, at least tomorrow at 9 o'clock, when we will look at the results. Thanks for listening, everybody, and happy middle age, or whatever age you are.